This is a second part of the sermon we began last week. Last week we reviewed the vision of the statue seen by Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 2, and noted that it is the foundational chapter of all Bible prophecy concerning the world, the Gentile nations, and the world history of the Gentile nations and their ruling. We covered some of the aspects of that, plus the transition to the Persian government, and then the transition to the Greek under Alexander the Great. And then we pretty much left off as we began the discussion of Rome, which was the fourth beast described as more terrible and more dreadful than the other three. And in chapter 7, it did mention devouring and doing the various things that described that unbelievable fourth beast. So today we are going to start a little more in depth about the Roman Empire, because it is the resurrections of the Roman Empire, and in fact the final one that we are looking forward to, in the sense as that is going to be an event necessary before Jesus Christ returns. And some of the events we have seen in Europe, especially with the gradual collapsing or crumbling, it seems like, of the EU, and that being perhaps replaced by a military group of about 10 nations, we'll see how that works out, but certainly there has been much talk and a lot in the news about that the last 2 weeks. First, a brief history of Rome. The founding of Rome goes back to the very early days. It is so old they call themselves the Eternal City. Romans believe their city was founded in 753 BC, but modern historians believe it was closer to about the year 625 BC. And you can read the stories of Romulus and Remus, who were abandoned by their mother because they were... It's kind of a long story, but she was illegitimately with child, and so they had to be abandoned in the Tiber River. And, of course, the story was the she-wolf came along and nursed them for a while until a farmer came along and rescued them. And, of course, then Remus died. Romulus became the founder of Rome. And if there's any truth in that, I would be surprised, that story, but certainly it is well known. And if you read a history of Rome, it will come up. Nevertheless, most historians believe that Rome began to be a city of importance in about 625 BC. And of course, at that time, the Romans only controlled Rome. The rest of the Italian peninsula was also just a variety of small city-states on the model of ancient Greece. Early Rome was governed by seven kings. I believe we have most of their names, but we have no record of what they did. All we have is that years later, Roman historians like Tacitus wrote that these Roman kings became tyrants and were oppressing their people and acting like they had the authority of life and death and they owned everything. And so after seven kings of ancient Rome, meaning the early ancient Rome, the Romans then had a revolt and they threw off their kings. Their Senate, which had been formed as an advisory committee to the kings, then became the ruling body of ancient Rome. This was the founding of the Roman Republic. The word Roman Republic itself comes from the Latin res publica, which means public matters or matters of state. Now, the Senate appointed a consul, and he ruled Rome like a king, but a consul only ruled for 1 year. It was a wise idea because what happened was the consul ruled carefully and not as a tyrant, for he knew that the next consul could punish him if he got out of line. And this method of rotating Roman consuls one after another got to the place where two of them ruled by the time of about the 240s or so BC. They would appoint two consuls for 1 year, and they would rule simultaneously. And when they had disagreements, obviously, it was kind of a serious thing. But at any rate, the Roman consul and the Roman Republic system lasted for almost 500 years, officially from about 510 BC until the year 23 BC, when Augustus declared himself emperor over all of Rome and greatly did away with the class of consul and greatly reduced the power of the Senate. In comparison, the United States of America has lasted less than half that long. And certainly the indication that our republic, as we have enjoyed it, would last another 260 years, fairly small. In Rome, there were four classes of people. This division was very important, and it is somewhat important for us to understand as we look back on the New Testament world. The lowest class were slaves. They were owned by other people, and they had no rights at all. The next class were plebeians. They were free people, but they had little say except that they were able to vote. And they were voting for men who would then represent them in the Senate, and these men were called tribunes. If you've watched some of the great old biblical movies, you've heard people addressed as tribune. Well, the tribunes were elected or chosen, normally on the field of Mars, where they counted all their ballots and were able to put their groups together and elect people. And the tribunes then were elected about every year, and but they would last. This kind of history is a little bit fuzzy, but sometimes they would be a tribune for not life, but for a long time, sometimes only for a year. But eventually the tribunes had somewhat of a veto power over laws that were passed in the Senate. That way the rich and the wealthy could not oppress the average person as much, you know, at least wise legally, as much as they were doing financially. So the plebeians were free people, and they had a certain amount of say because they had tribunes representing them, but they had very little influence overall. The second highest class were called equestrians. Sometimes they were called knights. That's where we get the term knights of the Middle Ages, because equestrians were people who owned property and had enough money to have a horse. So if you had a horse, that meant you were fairly wealthy in those times. That, of course, today we all have cars, so we could, I guess we're all part of the equestrian class, but even that is not really a good parallel. So the name riders were given to the horse and a rider if they were called to fight for Rome. In the early days especially, the equestrian class were the warriors that defended Rome. You almost had to be a landowner and an equestrian to be able to fight in the Roman army. And years later, they, of course, expanded that not only to include plebes and then slaves, but also foreign mercenaries. But finally, the highest class were the nobles of Rome, and they were called patricians. And they were the real power in Rome. Real power in Rome lay with them. And they were pretty much the senators and their business associates and their contemporaries. So Rome was basically ruled by this class of nobles. And if you read through the time of the transition from the Republic to the Roman Empire, beginning in about 63 with Pompey and some of the other generals, Pompey, and then later, of course, Cassius, and, of course, finally Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar's big complaint was that the patricians, the ruling class of Rome, which consisted of about 300 wealthy families, was using Rome as a sort of a personal plantation, and they were living very, very wealthy, and then the average person, the plebeians and the slaves, were being oppressed. And, of course, the story continues to this day. I read an article this past week, just kind of an overview of history. And in most empires, in most nations, it takes about 300 years for 1% of the people to own 99% of everything. And then normally it changes over, and again, the average person has land, and the average person has some goods, and then about 300 years later, again, 1% of the people own 99% of everything. And that's been the history of quite a number of nations down through the history of the world. And so in America, we are heading that direction. The 1% of the billionaires are gradually amassing more and more and more of everything, and the rest of us are left to kind of fight over the crumbs, and certainly the productive land in our society, which when it was divvied out to families, created a great deal of wealth and was modeled on the way Joshua, under God, had set up land in the Promised Land. And that led to, of course, the greatest nation in history. But as that is now being replaced by huge corporate farms and the productive land being taken up and then people being moved into cities and much smaller houses, we see the same process occurring. The greatest challenge during the Roman Republic years was Carthage. Carthage was a very powerful city in North Africa. And for several centuries, Carthage and Rome were basically on a par as far as power goes. Control of the Mediterranean was important. Finally, the Romans decided in this series of wars called the Punic Wars. Most of you probably are familiar with those. I think there were three, but two that were significantly large. The great Roman orator Cato was famous for what saying? Carcalgo galando est, exactly. Carthage must be plowed under. And when he was an ancient guy, like in his 90s with a cane, he would get into the Senate and scream, Carthago delando est. And what he meant was, we have to defeat the enemy and plow it under, or else we will never achieve the empire that we must have. So finally, there was in the year 146, this is in the 200s, of course, we had Hannibal crossing the Alps with his elephants, coming down and winning every battle he fought in Italy except the one to conquer Rome. Rome had a significant wall at that time. So after hanging around the Italian peninsula for about a decade, he finally went home. And in 146 BC, a very famous Roman named Scipio Africanus finally conquered Carthage. I think it was for the third time they took the city. Second and third time he completely, and he just decided it's over with, and he tore all the walls down, tore the city up, plowed it under, so to speak, and then sowed the city with salt. They put salt on all the farmland around there. But finally, the words of Cato came to pass in 146 BC, and Rome had about 100 years, again, of some peace, and certainly they were getting to be dominant across the entire Mediterranean. Rome's most famous citizen was no doubt Julius Caesar. He was a Roman politician and general who, without having any orders to do so, conquered vast territory in the north, north of France, and what we call Gaul. In the year 49, Caesar crossed a small river between his province and Italy called the River Rubicon and conquered Rome itself, which then he ruled as a dictator. His military campaigns took him to Egypt, where he met Cleopatra, and his life was ended infamously as he was murdered then in the Senate in Rome. And that murder was, of course, enshrined in history through the play Julius Caesar, written by Shakespeare, and the famous words, "Beware the Ides of March." After Caesar, there were many emperors of Rome, Augustus being the first who declared himself emperor. Caesar just wanted to clean out the patrician families that were causing trouble and then replace or continue with the republic if he could, but I think he's been misunderstood down through history, but that's my opinion, never having met him and only read a few things about him, so don't take much stock in it. But Rome had some very famous emperors. The most famous, of course, was Augustus. And Augustus, whose given name was Octavian, was the nephew of Julius Caesar. Augustus may have been the most capable and brilliant governor of men that ever lived, with the exception, obviously, of Jesus Christ. But the organization of the nation of Rome and the entire empire is still with us today. Much of what Augustus did, we are still doing. There were 17 major highways that came into Rome, and so every highway had a little mile marker all the way up into Britain, all the way over into, although Augustus' time, Britain wasn't part of Rome. That came later with Claudius. But all over the empire, in the Spain, Portugal, North Africa, the Middle East, Augustus put up mile markers so that anytime anybody was traveling, they would know how far it was to Rome. Now, anybody ever see a mile marker? About exit 32, exit 46, coming up on mile whatever, any road anywhere around here. Well, you can just thank Augustus Caesar for the mile markers. That was his idea. Counties were his idea. And various other things, Roman law, which later became the basis for European law, much of which was written into the Magna Carta and eventually in our Constitution, all came down from Augustus. Augustus's motivation was pretty simple. He was tired of civil war. He had fought civil wars for 4 years. He'd seen Julius Caesar's wars not only in Spain and then all over the area of the Mediterranean. And finally, as Octavian, when he defeated Pompey and then finally Mark Antony in Europe, in Egypt, he said, "I have to set up a system to govern his empire where there will be no more civil wars." He was tired of Roman armies killing off Roman armies. And so what Augustus did was establish what became known as the Pax Romana, or the Peace of Rome, so that everywhere there was Rome, there was an established army to keep the peace. They didn't have police. They simply had soldiers that were established. They had sort of a national guard. They had roads that could be transversed very quickly. Many of the roads that are paved over today are just old Appian Way or old Roman roads. They were so well built. Go on the internet sometime and look at how the Romans built roads. They built things to last. When we were at the feast in Portugal about 8 years ago, we drove over two bridges built by the Romans, which begs the question, if they could build bridges that lasted 2,000 years, why do we have to replace ours every 70 or 80? And one of the bridges, what's the I-5 bridge, 85 years old, we have to replace it now. I mean, why couldn't we just have built bridges that lasted 2,000 years or more like the Romans? But we don't, so that's a side issue. At any rate, the Roman world was custom made for the spreading of the gospel. So after 31 AD, and the day of Pentecost and the disciples understanding they were to go into all the world and preach the gospel. Free travel. You could go to a port anywhere, board a ship, and just pay your fee and go anywhere you wanted to in the Mediterranean. The roads were, for the most part, very safe. They were paved. They were graded. They had, some of the roads even had posts in them, so chariots couldn't go any far. They had certain parking areas where chariots had to park. And if you've been to Pompeii, you can see some of those where the road coming into Pompeii has ruts in it for the Roman chariots. And then there were little like fire hydrant looking posts all around these big open areas, the cardos, the areas where they had the open air markets covered with tents. And that was off limits for the chariots. So the Romans had these posts, which we now have in front of our gas station pumps so the cars don't hit the gas stations and other things. But that's also a Julius or a Augustus Caesar invention. So we have a lot of the remnants of the Roman Empire with us today. We could talk about Claudius and conquering Britain, Nero and all the things he did in beginning persecuting the Christians, Titus, the emperor who, as a general, when his father was Vespasian, was the emperor, Titus destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, of course, that was there during his time. Then Titus became the emperor of Rome, and of course, what was the most famous thing that happened when Titus was emperor? It was Pompeii. The city of Pompeii was destroyed by Mount Vesuvius, which many of the Jews and Christians said was God's revenge on Titus for destroying Jerusalem. The problem was Titus didn't get hurt. He was sitting in Rome having fun at his villa, and he heard this explosion, and then he heard reports of all the destruction in Pompeii, but certainly it was during the two-year reign of Titus when that occurred. The greatest, perhaps, was Trajan of the emperors after Augustus. He was a great skilled conqueror. The empire reached its peak under his time, and he was, by all accounts, a man of high character and did a great job ruling the Roman Empire. And the church itself was able to grow and do some things during that time that boded well for the future. Many others, Hadrian built a wall across northern England, and then Diocletian, who split the empire in two, east and west, and that breach was later then healed by Justinian in about 554 AD. What eventually destroyed Rome was being overrun by millions of barbarians from the east and the north. They were always able to stop enemy armies, but they simply were not able to stop massive numbers of people who were trying to move into Rome and then flooding the Italian peninsula. And finally, the Visigoth king Odoacer has been for about this third time, then took Rome in 476 AD and destroyed the city and declared the Roman Empire over, but it really wasn't over because it was to have 10 more resurrections that would come about, and we were in the middle of waiting for the last one. Now, with that background on Rome, let's go to Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8, most interesting chapter. It's gives us more detail. As we mentioned last time, Daniel chapter 2 is the foundational chapter in all the Bible for the history of the world. Daniel chapter 6 then begins to add a little bit, but really Daniel chapter 7 is where these kingdoms are described in more detail. And we have some really good prophecy, and of course we went through some of that last week as we went through all of Daniel chapter 7. You can skip over to Daniel chapter 9, but then to come back to chapter 8 is very important. Because here we have more detail, another vision that's interpreted that gives us more detail about what is going to occur in the time of the end. So Daniel 7 gives us a lot more detail about the statue, and Daniel 9, of course, begins the prophecy of the 70 weeks. But now I want to look at Daniel chapter 8. It begins in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. A vision appeared to Daniel. So it appeared to him like the one at the first time. So about 2 years after the fall of Babylon, we may look somewhere around, I don't know, 530 BC or somewhere in that range. I was in the vision. It happened. I was looking that I was in Shushan, the citadel in the province of Elam, and I saw the vision. I was by the river Ulai. I lifted up my eyes and saw, and behold, there was a ram standing by the river, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, one higher than the other. As we mentioned last week, that was the Persian and Median empires. The higher one came up last. It became known as Persia, not Media. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. He did according to his will and became great. So Persia became a great empire, replacing the empire of Babylon. I was considering, and suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth. Greece had been attacked by Xerxes a number of times. They had been saved by some miraculous, it seems, battles such as Marathon and by a gale out in the Adriatic that sank a number of the Persian boats. Almost overnight, after the death of King Philip, Alexander, his son, was able to coalesce the many city-states of Greece, Macedonia, put together an army of about 36,000, and go very, very fast to the east. During his conquering the next few years, he averaged 30 miles a day as his army traveled across the land, as it mentions here, in a swift fashion. He didn't even touch the surface of the earth, is the way that this vision describes it. It says, it had a notable horn between his eyes, and it came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. Probably the beginning of the Battle of Granicus River, and in some other battles where Alexander confronted armies much larger than his, Persian armies, and yet defeated them time after time. I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him and attacked the ram and broke his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to withstand him. And Xerxes was eventually captured and killed. Verse 8, the male goat grew very great, and when he became strong, the large horn was broken. So by 323, Alexander had conquered all the way over to Afghanistan. He had conquered all of northern India, or at least much of northern India. The only battle he ever lost was against the elephants as he was trying to go farther south into India. And his generals just said, enough is enough. We've conquered all that we need to conquer. We don't need to do any more fighting. We all want to go home. So they began the trek then back to Macedonia. But Alexander became sick, and he died in the throne room of Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. After he died, he had no heirs, so his empire was divided up into four kingdoms, according to four of his generals, four of his greatest generals. So he became strong, the large horn was broken, in place of it were four notable ones that came up towards the four winds of heaven. So there was an eastern, a northern, a southern, and a western kingdom. Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, and towards the glorious land. So these four generals, it took them about 9 years. Actually more than that, about 20 years. It was 301 BC when they finally finalized all of the lines, all the borders between those four kingdoms. Alexander dying in 323, so pushing 21, 22 years. And there was a lot of contest between these generals during this time, and they finally divided up into the four kingdoms. Now, out of one of them came a little horn, so we had a big horn, Alexander. Now we have a smaller horn, so it's a general, but it's a smaller general in power, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, east, and the glorious land. So if he moved to the south and to the east, that meant he was located in the north and perhaps somewhat to the west of Jerusalem. So we're talking about the kingdom of the Seleucidae. The Seleucids were the people, or the general Seleucid was the guy who took the kingdom around Syria, Asia Minor, and a little bit to the east of that. To the south of him were the Ptolemies. Ptolemy was one of the generals. Ptolemy Soter was the first Ptolematic king, and he controlled Egypt, Arabia, down into Ethiopia, much of North Africa. And by the way, the Ptolemites, the Ptolematic kingdom, lasted longer than the other three. The other three were absorbed into Rome or disappeared basically from scene much earlier than the Ptolemies. And the Ptolemies had, I believe, is it 14 or 16 kings or queens? You can see lists of them. And the last one was who? But was that? I know, but you know too much. Well, somebody else here has to know something about. Yeah, well, Cleopatra was the final Ptolemaic king, and she, I think, killed herself in 30 BC, but that's close to it, somewhere along in there. Anyway, 30 BC is about the time when the Greek kingdom of the Ptolemies finally was over with. So here we have in Daniel chapter 8, this horn, which is a general in the Seleucid kingdom, moving towards the south and the east and the glorious land, or Jerusalem, the area of Palestine and Judah. It grew up to the host of heaven. So it came to the host of heaven and cast down some of the host. Now, this is history written in advance. This prophetic chapter written in the 500s, early 400s BC, actually came to pass in the 100s BC. So we're talking 350 years before it actually occurred. So those who are skeptics of Bible history and whether or not it was inspired have a challenging time understanding how all this could be predicted ahead of time and then come to pass. And of course, the most astounding is Daniel chapter 11, which lists things like a luncheon where two guys got into an argument and listed it several hundred years in advance. And I'll tell you how smart God is. How did God make sure that nobody could accuse this of being written after the fact? This is pop quiz. You know the answer, Nathan, you probably do. Okay, because all this part of Daniel is written in the Chaldean language. And the Chaldean language was not in use when these events came to pass. This being written in Chaldee several hundred years before the Chaldee language disappeared and the Greek language took over. If it was written in Greek, everybody would say, well, it's written afterwards. Obviously, it's written in Greek. But the fact that it's written in Chaldee, a language that was not even in use when the events took place, is proof that it was written centuries before the events took place. So people sometimes ask, well, why is part of Daniel written in Chaldee originally, whereas the rest of it, the Old Testament, is written in Hebrew? The answer very likely is because God wanted to make sure that nobody said Daniel was written after the fact. It was not. It was written several hundred years before these very specific prophetic events were predicted. Before they took place. Okay, well, let's continue on now. We have Antiochus Epiphanes, who was a very evil guy, who does several things. He grew up to the host of heaven. Now, what in the world does that mean? It cast down some of the hosts. What does that mean? Some of the stars to the ground were trampled. What does that mean? He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices is in italics, so the daily was taken away and cast in the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Well, to understand what it's talking about, we need to do a little more research. I have an article about Antiochus from the Jewish Encyclopedia that we can read to you here, for at least read excerpts of. Antiochus was a king of Syria who reigned from 175 B.C. and died in 164. He was the son of Antiochus the Great, and after the murder of his brother Seleucus, took possession of the Syrian throne, which rightly belonged to his nephew Demetrius. So he ascended to the throne of the Seleucid kingdom, which is Syria, kind of today, modern-day Syria, some of the Kurdistan area, part of Turkey, and a little bit over to the east into Iraq. But he took the throne through murdering his brother and then through intrigue, cheating his nephew out of the throne. The rabbinical sources call him the wicked one. He's simply called the wicked person in rabbinical writings. Abundant information is extant concerning the character of this monarch who exercised great influence upon Jewish history and the development of their religion. Since Jewish and heathen sources agree in their characterization of him, their portrayal is evidently correct. Antiochus combined in himself the worst faults of the Greeks and Romans and none of their good qualities. He was vainglorious and fond of display to the verge of eccentricity. His sojourn in Rome, by the way, when he was young, he was taken as a hostage to Rome so that the Seleucid kings would be loyal to Rome. You may be familiar with the practice that went on for many, many centuries, that if two countries were sort of in a tenuous peace, then they would exchange sons of the kings, and one would become a hostage in the other place. And so if the war broke out, then the sons would get obviously executed. So it was a way of creating peace in the world. One of the more famous hostages was a guy named Herod. And it was, Agrippa. I think he was the son of Archelaus. Anyway, Herod Agrippa grew up in Caesar's household in Rome because he was a hostage so that King Herod would be loyal to Rome during the time when Jesus Christ was young and even before that. So we have a very famous hostage that we all know about, Herod Agrippa, and he finally, of course, is the one who boasts about himself, or at least allows others to brag about him. He dies of worms. But he grew up as a very famous hostage of Rome. Antiochus also was when he was younger. But again, through intrigue, he was able to exchange with another one of his brothers and get sent back to Syria. And Tacitus is one of the historians that records some of these things for us. He became king, and he tried to establish himself as a very powerful, strong leader. He decided to attack down to the south and try to increase his area, his conquered territory. On the way down, to his attack on Egypt, he ended up playing intrigue with the temple priests in Jerusalem. The temple priests were, by the way, already fighting each other. There was the Tobiads, whose high priest was Onias II, and there was another group by a man named, kind of controlled by a man named Jason, who wanted to be the high priest. And as this has happened in 70 AD and even before that other times, the Jews often are fighting amongst themselves so severely that they are able to be conquered by a foreign country, or at least a foreign occupier coming in. So during this time of a lot of schisms and fighting over the high priesthood in Jerusalem, Antiochus was able to get the Tobiads to let him into the city free of charge and make him sort of their honorary king as long as they got to stay in charge of the priesthood. So the space, of course, Antiochus then, since he was in town and there was all this gold and all these good things in the temple and he needed gold and good things to pay for his army, decided to sack the treasury and to carry away the valuable utensils and also, of course, to sack the temple. He did not set up his statue or do the sacrificing of the swine on the altar yet. So then he went down in 168 to Egypt. In Egypt, he wanted to conquer the Ptolemies, and of course, it didn't work very well. He got defeated in a very huge battle, and he came back up, and as a way to at least go back home somewhat victorious, he decides to take his rage out upon Jerusalem. It says, he first entered Jerusalem amicably, then suddenly turning upon the defenseless city, he murdered, plundered, and burnt throughout its length and breadth. Men were butchered, women and children sold into slavery, and in order to give permanence to the work of desolation, the walls and some houses were torn down. The old city of David was fortified anew by the Syrians and made into a strong fortress. A royal decree proclaimed the abolition of the Jewish mode of worship. Sabbaths and festivals were not to be observed. Circumcision was not to be performed, and the sacred books were to be surrendered and burned. And he did burn many, many copies of the Old Testament or the scrolls at that time. The Jews were compelled to offer sacrifices to idols that had been set up in the temple area, and he himself supervised the sacrificing of a swine in the temple and the spreading of its blood all around the temple complex. The officers under his charge were compelled to carry out these orders with great vigor. The possession of a sacred book or the performance of circumcision on a son was punishable by death. It was during this time that he set up the statue of Zeus, who was an Olympic statue, and it was called later, of course, the Abomination of Desolation. So Antiochus moved in the statue. He made Sabbath worship and the true worship of God illegal. And, of course, all down through time, that was a very, very a terrible time for the Jews. It was not to last, though. A Hasmonean named Matthias Maccabeus, decided to organize a resistance. So he and his seven sons headed to the hills. Now, they armed themselves, and between 167 and 166, almost unbelievable military prowess and battles where they ambushed and attacked the Syrians, the conquering army. And after about 6 years, they finally drove the Syrians out of Palestine and set up then what became known as the Hasmonean government, which eventually was still in power, at least remnants of it, through King Herod and others when the Romans took over in 64 B.C. So we have this Antiochus Epiphanes, who is given to us here in Daniel chapter 8 and in several other places as an example, as a type of the beast who will be on the scene in the end time. So let's look at that. Let's reread verse 10 now of Daniel chapter 8 after having read some of that history. So we have this little horn, who we know as Antiochus Epiphanes. He grew up to the host of heaven. In other words, he made like he was friends with the high priests in Jerusalem. It cast down some of the host, because he did kill the ones who were not of the family of Tobias, and he, of course, set some of his men in power. But he cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground. He killed many Jews who were trying to worship God sincerely in the way that God wanted them to, and trampled them. He exalted himself as the prince of the host, proclaimed himself a great king or a great deity in the temple complex, And by him, the daily sacrifices, the word sacrifice there is not there in the Greek. It's in italics. The word for the daily, demuth, actually means ongoing worship or continual worship. It is used of showbread. It is used of basically all of the temple worship, all of the things that went on in the tabernacle. It can be used of sacrifices, but keep in mind the word sacrifices is added by the translators. The correct understanding, from what I can tell of all the Hebrew and the commentaries I've seen, is it really means the ongoing worship or the continual worship of God was stopped. It was taken away. And that included the sacrifices, the showbread, the lighting of the candles, the priests, all the things that were going on day and night. So all of the worship of God was stopped in Jerusalem by Antiochus Epiphanes. And the place of his sanctuary, meaning God's sanctuary, was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to impose the daily. Now, because of transgression means the corruption of the Jews who were ruling that land. Now, these were descendants of Ezra, Nehemiah, Joshua, Zerubbabel, and the 56,000 that came back with those men and others during the times of the exile return. And they landed in Jerusalem in, 537 B.C., more of them in 517, and then, of course, others when Ezra came back in about 454. So they had established themselves, and they had a temple that was rebuilt. We have record of that in Haggai and in a couple other books in the Minor Prophets. But we have this temple then that was really not much compared to the Solomonic temple, but it was functioning, and it existed until it was essentially taken out of the way, or the sacrifices there were stopped, the ongoing worship of God was stopped in 167 B.C. by Antiochus. It says in verse 12, this interesting statement, because of transgression, because they had become corrupt, and they were transgressing against God. The priesthood was being bought and sold, auctioned off virtually. An army was given over to the horn, in other words, to Antiochus, to oppose the worship, in other words, to cast it down. He cast truce to the ground. He made the burning of the Old Testament books policy. He also taught Hellenism. He did all this and prospered. So he lasted for a while. He prospered. Verse 13. Now Daniel says, I heard a holy one speaking. I heard another angel speaking. And another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation? So the transgression that made the desolation of the worship of God. How long would the daily worship be taken away and this desolation last? The giving of both of the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot. So we have the sanctuary being stopped, the continual worship of God being stopped, and the host, those who were in Jerusalem, not only the citizens of Jerusalem, the Jews, but also the priesthood and those who were trying to be honestly worshiping God according to the way it should be done, that they would be trampled underfoot. And he said to me, for 2,300 days, and then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Now this has been an enigmatic verse in the Bible, really for centuries. If you look at various commentaries and ideas on the subject, it will go all the way from what William Miller thought back in the 1800s, that the 2,300 days meant 2,300 years, and that would start in about 457 B.C., and he thought it would come to an end in 1844, which gave rise to the great disappointment, where many, many thousands of Americans left their places, quit their jobs and their farms, and went out on the hillsides to wait for Jesus Christ to return in 1844. And, of course, that did not occur, but two major American churches came out of that movement. That's the long of it, 2,300 days. There are others who believe, as my Matthew Henry's commentary mentions here, that the 2,300 days really is about 6 years and 3 months total time, and they try to make a case in history where for 6 years and 3 months the temple was desolate and the sacrifice was not going on, the worship of God was not being carried out, and they figure about 6 years for the time of the rebellion of Matthias and Judas Maccabee to have finally come to its victory, where they then were able to drive the Syrians out and then reestablish worship of God. That's difficult to document, and it's difficult to squeeze that into this six-year time period. But in the middle of that, there is the 2,300 days, and it really says days and nights, meaning a morning sacrifice and an evening sacrifice. Years ago, Dr. Herman Hay wrote an article called The 2300 Days, which I printed out a copy of, and I suggest you reread it again. Very, very, very well done. And he just mentions here that what it's really, the question is, how long will the sanctuary be desolate until it is restored? And this is after it has been cast down and the people are being trampled. In Matthew 24, Jesus Christ talked about Jerusalem shall be trodden underfoot until the times of the Gentiles are over. And I believe we correctly understand that as being for about a 3.5-year period. So very likely this 1150 days fits within the 3.5-year period, which is 1260 days, as a time during which the beast power is on the earth, the great tribulation is going on, other momentous events are going on, and that this little horn will be an example for all of us to learn something about. Now, the last part of the chapter, the angel explains what all this means. And guess what? It means something is going to happen yet in the future. It wasn't just in 167. What the angel was saying the vision stood for was a type or a chain of events that would be similar to a chain of events at the end time. And an individual who would do and say things in 167 BC and the years before that, just like an individual in the years right before Christ's return would do. So, this is an example that we all need to understand very well, because Jesus Christ said, when you see the abomination of Daniel set up in Jerusalem, the abomination of desolation, then he adds that note, you had better understand Daniel, or let him that reads understand what Daniel said. So, verse 15, it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning. There's a whole book of Daniel. Daniel say, what does this understand? What does this mean? I would understand that. And so some of these visions are explained to him, but at the end, finally, the angel says, go your way. This is sealed up until the time of the end when many wise people will understand it. So Daniel says, what is the meaning? And suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. So this angel stands before him. In answer to this question, I heard one man's voice between the banks of the Ulai who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So Gabriel then is the angel's name who is explaining this vision to Daniel. He came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. He fell down before this glorious shining being, this angel, Gabriel. Understand, he said, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. So as Gabriel begins to explain this vision and this he-goat and all the things that happen, he says this is going to happen at the time of the end. It isn't just in 167 BC or some other events 350 years hence. Now as he was speaking with me, I was in deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright. So the angel kind of grabs him, stands him up, wakes him up. He said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation. Now, the indignation could be the time when the temple is no longer functioning, when after it's destroyed in 70 AD, or perhaps even earlier than that, the time of the indignation is going to come to an end, and there will be a new temple rebuilt in Jerusalem after Jesus Christ returns. But this is going to be happening at the latter time of the indignation. And the indignation here could also be the persecution of God's people, but something that is very indignant in God's eyes is necessary to fulfill this. And some of these events here are obviously in that category. It says, for at the appointed time, the end shall be. When these events come to pass, you are at the end. This is something you must be aware of at the end, because at the appointed time of these things, the end shall be. The ram which you saw having two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. We don't guess about those. We are told plainly by Gabriel that's who they were. The male goat is the kingdom of Greece. Okay, that's Alexander, very plain. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. We understand that. As for the broken horn, Alexander died in 323 BC. The four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. So these four generals, north, south, east, and west, divided up Alexander's kingdom, and they had various conflicts among themselves. The Macedonian area was very quickly absorbed into Rome, and of course other things. Bithynia took over part of up into the north, but that's other history. The important thing became the Seleucids, the king of the north, and the Ptolemies, the king of the south. Notice verse 23, in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness. So we're talking here in verse 23 about the latter time of their kingdom. Keep in mind that Rome absorbed Greece and that the Roman Empire had aspects of the first three, like a lion, like a leopard, and like a bear. In the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, in other words, when evil has reached its peak on the earth, and we are seeing much of that happen right before our eyes, a king shall arise having fierce features who understands sinister schemes. So we're looking for an individual to rise who will be a charismatic leader. He will have fierce features. He will not be a milquetoast individual. He will not be someone with a soft little voice who apologizes to world leaders or does whatever shouldn't be done. He has a fierce countenance and fierce features. He will probably be a great public speaker. He'll be able to galvanize nations and peoples under him. Notice he understands sinister schemes. He understands intrigue. He understands politics. He understands how to undercut others and get himself ahead, even as Antiochus did. Notice his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He receives power, as we know from several other scriptures, from Satan the devil, but he also receives power from the 10 nations that he coalesces under his leadership. These 10 nations give power to the beast for a short time. So his power shall be mighty, but not by his own. He doesn't rise being the king of some great nation. He simply rises by intrigue. It says, his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fiercely. He shall prosper and thrive. So he shall conquer. He will have a very prosperous and thriving administration for a short time. And notice the last part of verse 24. This is one of those verses or sentences you can't just read over quickly. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. So there are two groups he is going to attack, two groups he is going to be focusing on. Now, who are the mighty? Who are the mighty people that will be mighty at the time of the end, at the time when all of this evil comes to its head? Well, they are still the people who are inheriting the birthright of Ephraim and Manasseh, the birthright of Joseph that was passed on to him by his father and his father before him, Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob, and then down to Joseph. The mighty people of the earth, when the beast power comes on the scene, are still those who are the descendants receiving the blessing of Abraham, Abraham's obedience. So this beast power, this king that comes on, will destroy or will attack and will conquer the mighty, the Israelites, and also the holy people. Well, who are the holy people? Obviously, holy means set apart. It means sanctified. It means they have the Spirit of God. So we shall be used to punish the people of Israel who have allowed evil to conquer their nation and become their accepted policy, and also the holy people. He'll be used by the spiritual arm, the church, to persecute those, just like Antiochus was used, who are keeping the Sabbath and who believe in worshiping the true God. Verse 25, through his cunning shall he cause deceit to prosper under his rule. So through his cunning, his brilliance, his lies, his deceit, his manipulation of politics, people, and nations, he shall cause deceit or falsehood, lies to be believed, false religion to be worshipped. He shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. So this man will exalt himself. He will feel like he is unconquerable, like he is the greatest. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. So much of what he is doing is taking lands that are prosperous and areas that are doing fairly well financially. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken without human means. Now that is a very key sentence, that this individual will rise against the prince of princes. There are four places in the scriptures where there is a description of an individual or his beast rising against the returning Jesus Christ. So we put these verses together and we get a clear picture of things we have to look for, of hallmarks, of perhaps red flags waving in the air saying, this is the one spoken of by Daniel the prophet. So keep your place there if you would, but let's go over to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 2. When the Apostle Paul wrote this, very likely he was in his mind referring back to Daniel chapter 8, because he knew what Daniel chapter 8 said, and he knew what this individual was going to do, and he pretty much quoted what we just read in Daniel chapter 8. He paraphrased it, made it somewhat different, applied it to his time, but obviously he's talking about the same individual. First, he warns people not to be deceived, that Jesus Christ has already returned or is going to return in 2 or 3 days. In verse 7, he says, the mystery of lawlessness. Daniel talked about evil coming to its peak. He says, the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. It had not reached its peak in Paul's time, but it's reaching its apex in the times in which we live. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. There's a restraining force. Paul maybe felt that that was himself during his time. But certainly there is a restraining force that God has allowed so the gospel could be preached and the church could grow. But at some point, it'll be taken out of the way. Notice, then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. So this individual is the one who would stand up against the Prince of Princes and be broken without human means in Daniel chapter 8. We have the same individual prophesied by Paul as by Gabriel, talking to Daniel. Notice the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan. Remember, the lawless one in Daniel 8 didn't have his own power. He has power from another source. And he has power, signs, and lying wonders, intrigue, politics, miracles, signs and lying wonders, with all unrighteous deception. So he's deceiving the world among those who are perishing. The Greek word is actually in a continual sense that these people are in the process of perishing because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. So here we have this individual in these four verses described in almost exactly the same words, but certainly the same terms as we had back in Daniel chapter 8. A lawless one is going to be revealed. He'll just come onto the scene. He'll come out of the sea, as it mentions. Also, he's going to be around for a short time, and then the Lord will destroy him with the brightness of his coming. He also does a lot of miracles. Let's go back to Revelation chapter 17 and verse 14. We'll come back to Revelation 17 later. But here we have the third place where this individual and his system confronts the returning Jesus Christ. We want to make sure that we know who we're talking about. So we have in verse 12 of Revelation 17, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet. That's where we are. You know, the EU had 26 members and 2 that were on probation, 28. They lost one last week. There are about 7 others who are having some sort of elections or decisions to perhaps leave. This last week, Chancellor Merkel in Germany and several others called for a smaller group with its own military power. Not unreasonable at all to think that it may only be 10 nations. Certainly Poland wants to be a part of it, several others. 10 nations that would have an ability to come together very quickly and form their own military power. So we are right now in the place where we have 10 horns, but we haven't received their kingdom yet. So we are sort of in this verse. We're in the other verses too, but this is certainly sort of alive before our eyes. They receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. They are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. Remember, the beast doesn't have his own power. He comes out of the sea, and he gets power from these 10 and from Satan the devil, who gives him power. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called faithful and chosen. Those are very likely the returning saints who meet Jesus Christ in the air and then come back and are part of that battle at the day of the Lord in Jerusalem. So we have this third account of this individual, this beast, and these 10 nations that try to stop the returning Christ when he comes back to the earth. And, of course, they don't do a very good job. Revelation 19 and verse 11, let's go on over there to finish the fourth place, where this individual who will fight the returning Jesus Christ after having deceived the world is given to us. Revelation 19 and verse 11, I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on him was called Faithful and True. So Jesus Christ is faithful. He keeps his word. He is true. His word never fails. In righteousness, he judges and makes war. He's coming back to make war and judge the earth in righteousness, not out of vengeance, not out of spite, but out of righteousness, so that righteousness can someday prevail. His eyes were like a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. He had a name written that no one knew except himself. So he has a name that he's going to reveal, but right now when he returns, no one knows but himself. He was clothed in a robe dipped in blood. He had been the sacrifice for all the sins of mankind. And his name is called the Word of God. In the beginning was the Word was God, the Word was with God. John chapter 1 and verse 1. And the armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, fine linen is the garment of righteousness of the saints, white and clean, followed him on white horses. So it's appropriate that I guess we learn to ride a horse now. That's why we're having horses at camp, so all these kids can learn to ride on horses, although some of us have tried several times and not been very successful at riding horses, but maybe they'll be spirit horses, obviously, and will behave a little better. At any rate, the armies in heaven are clothed in clean white, and they are following Jesus Christ on white horses. Out of his mouth goes a sharp sword that with it he should strike the nations. And he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. He himself treads the winepress of the fierceness and the wrath of Almighty God. And all he has on his robe and his thigh a name written, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So there we have this description of his name. Down in verse 19, I saw the beast, that's the beast we've been reading about, the kings of the earth, these 10 kings, and their armies, gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. So, first given in Daniel 8, that a man would come on the scene, gather nations together, and try to fight the returning Jesus Christ, prophecy given in the 500s B.C., very likely. Now we have the final account of it, several thousand years later, 2,500 or whatever. So we have them gathering their armies together, trying to fight the returning Jesus Christ, but the beast is captured, with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence, which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image, and they were cast alive into the lake of fire. So they're burned, essentially burned alive in the lake of fire. So we have this description four times in the Bible of this individual in Daniel chapter 8 who will rise against the prince of princes and be broken without human means. And the last verse in Daniel chapter 8 simply says, the vision of the evenings and mornings, meaning the vision of this worship that's going to be taken away and then essentially replaced when Christ returns, is true, which was told is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. So saying this is talking about the future, not about now. This is talking about something that's going to occur not just in a few hundred years, but instead at the end of time. I want to go over now to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11, we'll skip over Daniel's incredibly beautiful prayer in Daniel chapter 9 and the answer to that prayer concerning Greece and Persia in chapter 10. Let's go to Daniel chapter 11. We'll begin in verse 1. In the first year of Darius the Mede, this will be after the fall of Babylon when the Persian Empire has begun. By the way, this is not Daniel talking. This is the angel Michael talking, very likely, because there's the angel talking to Daniel, and he's telling him, when Babylon fell, I was there to help Darius the Mede do that. Maybe he was the one that opened the gates or caused the river to get lower, caused the whatever strategy it was to lower the river and open the gates and have the armies come in. And, of course, the people of Babylon were having a party. Most leadership was drunk. And, of course, we have the handwriting on the wall. So we understand quite a bit from Daniel's history about what he's talking about. So here we have the angel saying, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I, being the angel, stood up to confirm and strengthen him. I helped him conquer Babylon very quickly, 539 BC. And then he says, I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia. So again, we have written in Chaldee a prophecy about the future kings of Persia. So these three kings were number one, Cyrus, number two, Artaxerxes, Cambyses, and the third king prophesied here was very likely Ahasuerus, who was the one who married Queen Esther. So here we have Darius, Cyrus, then Artaxerxes, and then Ahasuerus, and he says there'll be a fourth one after them. And the fourth one, of course, was Xerxes. Xerxes was pathetically and inaccurately portrayed in that movie, The 300, one of the movies I simply walked out on after paying my $8 or $10 to see it. I thought it was going to be historically accurate. And, of course, Hollywood turned it into a sort of an outlandish cartoon. It was just ridiculous. But at any rate, it would have been a great movie had they done it correctly. But that's another. I don't want to get off on movies that are done incorrectly because it makes me angry. I have a hard time with self-control. I'm just kidding. But anyway, it was very poorly done. It would be nice if there was a accurate portrayal of Xerxes. Perhaps there's one on History Channel or YouTube. But Xerxes, it says here, will be far richer than them all. By his strength through his riches he shall stir up against the realm of Greece. And Xerxes did. History records he put together an army of 800,000 men, plus an old untold number of horsemen and all the various support vehicles and things that went with him. He marched to the west up through what today is called Turkey. And then, of course, he crossed the Bosporus. He built the first bridge across the Bosporus up to what is now Istanbul. It was a floating bridge, so it didn't last a long time. But it was able to move his army, not only on ships, but also across the land, which the Greeks were not prepared for. And through several miraculous battles, such as Marathon and some others, over a period of years, the Greeks were able to repel the attacks of Xerxes. Even though Xerxes outnumbered them by hundreds to one in some battles like Thermopylae. But eventually, Xerxes went home, and Alexander the Great said, we got to stop this, so we are going to send our armies, gather an army together of all these Greek states, and attack and destroy Xerxes, which, of course, he did. So we're covering some territory here that's already been covered in previous prophecies here in Daniel. So Xerxes was rich. He was a mighty king. He says, then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. This is Alexander the Great. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided towards the four winds of heaven. That's the four generals who took Alexander's kingdom and broke it up into four pieces. Not among his posterity. So Alexander did not have any children. It was not given to his son. It was given to his generals. For his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. Then we begin the king of the south and the king of the north. And this is a very important description. In this case, we have the king of the south, the Ptolemies, who are parleying back and forth with the king of the north, the Seleucides. And, of course, most famous of those was Antiochus the Great and then his son Antiochus Epiphanes. So we have this struggle that continues down until the time when Christ returns, because this struggle is a type for all of us to understand. Notice, he shall have dominion, for the king of the south shall become strong as well as one of his princes. He shall gain power over him, have dominion, his dominion shall be a great one. At the end of some years they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north. They tried to have this agreement, where I think her name was Bernice, one of the daughters of one of the kings came up from the south and married one of the north, and of course that didn't work, and they started, more of their killing and their battles back and forth. And this entire chapter of Daniel is incredible in its detail of events prophesied 300 or 400 or 500 years in advance. But let's drop down a little bit farther. We get into the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. Verse 32. Let's start in verse 30. Ships from Cyprus shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return in a rage against the Holy Covenant. So when Antiochus attacked in Egypt, the Egyptians got reinforcements, I think from the Romans primarily, and he then had to return back to Jerusalem, where he returned in a rage. We read that in that historical paper I read in the comment, the article from the Jewish Encyclopedia. And he destroyed the city and did damage against the people, began to enforce no circumcision, no Sabbath keeping, and to enforce Hellenistic idol worship. He shall return to show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. So he had a league with those, especially those who were in the priesthood, who turned against the holy covenant. Verse 31, forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily or the ongoing worship of God and place there the abomination of desolation. Jesus Christ said, you need to understand Daniel's description of the abomination of desolation, which is given to us here now for the second time. And history shows it was a statue of Zeus or statue of Zeus Olympus that was placed in the temple as the swine were sacrificed and the other idols were set up, the Greek idols to be sacrificed to. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, which he did. We have historical records of that. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. A vivid prophecy about Judas Maccabee, his father Messias, and some of his brothers, and the Maccabean revolt that eventually turned away this massive army, many, many times their size, much, much better equipped, better trained. But because of their faith in God, the Maccabees did great exploits. And if you haven't read the books of the Maccabees, which are contained in the Apocrypha, they're not part of the Bible, they're just historical books. But they make great reading. They're very, very vivid in their descriptions. And if you've not read them, I strongly suggest that you do so. Because these people were just filled with faith, filled with energy. They knew God would bless them, which he did. They're also mentioned in Hebrews 11 as being part of the examples of faith. They were the ones who lived in caves and the ones who fought, described in the last part of Hebrews chapter 11, among the list of the faithful. Notice verse 33, those of the people who understand shall instruct many. So there were people who held on to the truth back then, held on to the Torah, all the books they had, and they instructed many. And yet for many days they would fall by sword, by flame, by captivity and plundering. And when they shall fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join to them by intrigue. So there was a two-pronged attack against them, one military and the other intrigue, trying to join with them. Some of them of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. So verse 35 is telling us these are events to take place at the time of the end. That Antiochus and all that he did in the 160s BC were something that we need to look for happening again. Intrigue, some people of understanding falling. Some holding fast to the faith and doing great exploits, which I hope includes all of us. There'll be help with a little help. Then verse 36, the king shall do according to his own will. When this end time king comes on the scene, he'll do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god. Remember what it said in 2 Thessalonians 2? They would sit in the temple of God saying that he was God. Speak blasphemous things against the God of gods. And shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. The wrath against those two groups, the mighty people and the holy people. We read about it in chapter 8. So this king shall prosper until the wrath has been accomplished, the wrath that God determines needs to punish the earth because of all of its evil and to bring the Israelites to their knees to where they want to come back and worship him. So until that has been done, he shall regard neither the God of his fathers nor the desire of women. He will kill indiscriminately children, husbands, fathers, whatever. He will not regard any God because he shall exalt himself above them all. He will sit in a place and proclaim that he is God. He will say perhaps he's the vicar of Christ or perhaps that he's Christ himself. In their place he shall honor a God of fortresses and a God which his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver. So he's going to honor a false god, an idol, and of course with gold and silver, precious stones, and precious things. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, foreign to the true God, a god from a foreign land, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many. In other words, enforce the mark of the beast. Revelation 13, cause those who are strong and great to have a mark in their hand and their forehead. He shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. And in verse 40, at the time of the end is not here yet, the end is coming. The king of the south, historically the area of Egypt, shall attack him, and the king of the north, historically the area of Europe or Rome, and of course Roman government to the north there, shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots. So modern day chariots, horsemen, many ships. He shall enter the countries, overwhelm them and pass through. So the king of the south attacks to the north. The king of the north, these 10 nations that are guided by this beast individual, comes at them like a whirlwind. He shall enter the glorious land. He'll enter Jerusalem. He'll enter Judah. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the people of Ammon. So he does not feel that Jordan is a threat or that the land of Jordan today warrants being taken over and occupied. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So the historical king of the south shall be controlled by the king of the north. He shall have power over treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. So definitely will conquer that area, and he shall be setting up his headquarters in Jerusalem. Notice verse 44. News from the east and the north shall trouble him. An army, a threat. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And that, of course, did not happen with Antiochus Epiphanes. That's entirely going to happen in the end time. War in the Middle East, a very serious and a very violent war taking place here, beginning with verse 44. He shall plant the tents of his palace. So the king of the north shall move his ruling capital, the tents of his palace, between the seas, between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea, where is located the city of Jerusalem, Mount Zion, the historical location of the temples of God, in the glorious holy mountain, Mount Zion. So he's going to place his headquarters on Mount Zion between the seas, and there he shall come to his end. He will be there when Christ returns, and that's where this individual that has control over these 10 nations will defiantly confront the returning Jesus Christ and there be defeated, not by hands, but by the supernatural God returning to rule the earth. Well, once again, I only got through about half of it, so next time we'll start in the beast in Revelation 13, talk about the differences between coming out of the sea and the land, and then, of course, prophecies about Israel and what we need to do.